This is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. The last place you're likely to see Paul Maevski is in a warm tropical climate. He's attracted to the cold, the really cold. Maevski is one of the few people who can rightly call themselves a glaciologist, and he spent many years doing research in remote places like Antarctica, the Himalayas, Greenland. He has found that ice is a reliable frozen library of information about past climate changes. By drilling into ice cores and analyzing ice samples, Maevski and his team have been able to gather a historical record of past ice ages, volcanic eruptions, warming trends, and more. This summer, Maevski spent 5 months in Greenland, where he directs the Greenland Ice Sheet Project 2. His team has been able to bore into the ice there and retrieve samples that go back 250,000 years. Greenland is a fertile site for this work because of the depth of the glaciers and the temperature. Even in the dead of summer, it never goes above freezing. Maevski and his co-workers have a sophisticated laboratory in the ice in Greenland, and in spite of having to wear thick gloves, thermal boots, and plenty of layers, they can do a lot of sophisticated research on site. The drill they use is about 100 feet high and is housed in a 52-foot diameter dome.
If you can imagine, it's sort of a corkscrew, and we basically screw it down into the ice. It collects a 5.2-inch diameter core, which is as long as 20 feet. And once we fill the barrel up with approximately 20 feet of ice, we pull it back up to the surface. It's on a very, very long cable, and put it onto a horizontal into a horizontal position, and then extrude or push out the core. And at that point, we begin to make a lot of the preliminary measurements on the core.
How far down have you been able to drill? What's the farthest you've been able to go?
Well, we actually have the world record in terms of depth of ice, which is an important fact for us, because it also means, more importantly, that we have the oldest and longest record in the world. We were able to drill down the exact depth in meters is 3053.44 meters. It's a little bit over 11,000 feet.
Okay, 11,000 feet, and how far back in time does that take you?
That 11,000 feet takes us back probably something close to 250,000 years. We have a great deal of confidence in being able to date the first 90 to 100,000 years of the record, because we actually see annual markers, which we've been able to count down as you would count tree rings down. When we get to the lower part of the core, approximately the lower 200 meters or about 650, 700 feet, much of the remaining 150,000 years is squashed down in that lower portion of the core. So it becomes a little bit harder to tell the exact age.
You have described these samples of ice as being like the Rosetta Stone. What kind of secrets are embedded in the ice?
Well, it's an amazing record. It's an potentially a very, very vivid, robust record of what our paleo environment has been. And we're able to, by measuring as many as 42 different parameters in any one sample, and doing this at very, very high resolution, great detail, and doing it continuously down the record, we're able to capture a great deal of information about what the atmosphere was comprised of, what the winds were like, what the temperatures were like. We can, for all purposes, draw a very, very vivid picture of the paleo environment.
Can you, though, generalize from the ice in Greenland to climatic conditions in more temperate climates or even in tropical climates?
The record in central Greenland is certainly telling us something about the atmosphere throughout a very, very large portion of the Arctic and probably throughout a great portion of the North Atlantic region. It does not necessarily tell us what was going on in the tropics, although with a very, very solid understanding of what went on in the Arctic, which tends to be, in terms of change in climate, a far more dynamic region, we could make some very, very good educated guesses about what the more temperate or tropical latitudes were doing. The way we get answers about the temperate and tropical latitudes is by collecting ice cores at very, very high elevations in Asia, which we can then calibrate or correlate back to the records in the polar regions like Greenland or Antarctica.
What then can you tell us about environmental conditions 250,000 years ago, looking either at the Arctic or looking at the North Atlantic region?
Perhaps the most remarkable thing that we found from our records is the fact that the last 10,000 years of Earth history, a time period which has seen the major growth in civilization, was a relatively mild and relatively stable period compared to the last 250,000 years. If we go back prior to our relatively warm time period, which is called an interglacial, a time between glacials, we find that the climate seems to, at least based on our ice core record, the climate in the North Atlantic and throughout the Arctic fluctuated very, very wildly. There would have been extremely strong winds that would have perhaps affected a region for several years and then suddenly stopped for a while. Temperature variations would have been very, very dramatic. In a word, it was a very, very tumultuous environment compared to the one that we live in today.
Do you know why there has been climatic stability in the last 10,000 years, though?
I'd say preliminarily, it's because of the fact that over the last 10,000 years, we have not had extensive ice cover over portions of North America and Europe. And because we haven't had that extensive ice cover, it means that the air masses which move over the northern hemisphere have not had large, white, slippery surfaces in which they can effectively pick up wind speed and also deviate in terms of their latitudinal position quite easily. So it's probably the presence of large ice sheets more than 10,000 years ago that created the instability. So, of course, the next question one asks oneself is why were the large ice sheets there prior to 10,000 or 11,000 years ago and not today? And perhaps the best good general answer is the relationship between the Earth and the Sun changes on a periodic basis. And when the Sun is relatively closer to the Earth in general terms, we have less likely conditions for glacier growth. And when the Sun is relatively far from the Earth, we have good conditions. And there are tens of thousands of year cycles which the Sun and Earth go through, changing their relative position.
I want to make sure I understand then the climatic changes or the instability that occurred more than 10,000 years ago. Do you see this as a result of the Earth's relationship to the Sun, or were there other things at work here on Earth?
There are a whole range of things that control climate. Perhaps one of the primary things is the relationship between the Earth and the Sun. It definitely sets the major stage for climate. It plunges the surface of the Earth into gradually cooler time periods or gradually warmer time periods. And it may very well explain the overall growth and decay of the very, very massive ice sheets that cover the northern hemisphere or large portions of the northern hemisphere. After that, however, there are a whole range of other things or factors which control climate. And they include things such as the greenhouse gases. Increases in greenhouse gases, CO2, methane, tend to trap heat at the surface of the Earth. Volcanic explosions give off both dust and also gases which tend to shield incoming radiation. There are a whole range of so-called forcing or climate forcing factors, and many of those we are actually able to measure in our ice core. So the remarkable thing about the ice core record is the fact that we not only have a detailed, vivid history of what the environment was, but we also are able to measure many of the things which can potentially cause the change in the climate.
What does a volcanic explosion look like in an ice core?
A volcanic explosion in an ice core is usually marked either by an ash layer. This is the particles that are thrown up by very explosive volcanoes, or by an increase in sulfuric acid because of the sulfur gases that are given off by the volcano. As of the last few decades, there's been an immense amount of interest in this, certainly recently because of Pinatubo, several years ago because of El Chichon. And we now know that it's primarily the gas, the sulfur gas, that's given off by these volcanoes that gets into the atmosphere, gets converted to sulfuric acid, and is very, very effective in shielding incoming radiation.
Can you see the start of the Industrial Revolution looking at the ice core?
Yes. That's an excellent question. We've been able to see very, very solid evidence for the onset of the Industrial Revolution using several different types of measurements. Perhaps the most precise of all of the measurements, again, is sulfuric acid. Volcanoes are not the only source of sulfuric acid in the atmosphere. It also comes from various biological organisms will give it off, particularly from the ocean, but also from the land. And as of about the last 100 years, in fact, beginning literally at the turn of the century, we see tremendous increases in sulfur dioxide measured in our core as sulfuric acid, which were produced by human activity, industrialization. And we not only see the start of this humanly produced pollution, but we can also see increases and decreases in the level of it, which mark very, very closely, or I should say parallel very, very closely, what we do know about emissions coming from factories, particularly coal-burning plants. And perhaps the most important thing is the fact that we not only see these oscillations in sulfuric acid in the Greenland ice core being produced by industry effectively turning up and turning down its coal burning, but we also see the effect of the Clean Air Act, which as of the early 1970s, in our particular record, shows that there was not the there was actually a leveling out of the pollution or the sulfuric acid that was contributed to the Greenland ice sheet from North American sources. So it's a very, very sensitive indicator, but it is only one of the indicators that we have of human activity.
We're going to take a very short break. My guest is Paul Majewski. He's a glaciologist and director of the Greenland Ice Sheet Project 2. We're talking about his research in Greenland, research looking at climate and climate change. He's also a professor in the Department of Earth Sciences and the Institute for the Study of Earth, Oceans, and Space at the University of New Hampshire. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is glaciologist Paul Majewski. What is the evidence that you're seeing of global warming? And as you mentioned earlier, there's a debate, I guess, back and forth whether we're in a warming trend or not. What does the ice tell you?
I think that perhaps before thinking, or I should say discussing global warming, perhaps the best thing to do is to define what is actually implied by global warming. I think in general we think of the term global warming because it has warming in it as implying that temperatures will increase in the future, largely because of the increased production of greenhouse gases, which are directly tied to population and combustion of fossil fuels. As it turns out, that may very well be the case. There are an awful lot of indications from a variety of records all over the world suggesting that temperatures are rising, but they don't necessarily rise everywhere the same amount, and they don't necessarily have to rise constantly. And I say that because we can very often counteract the effects of global warming or temperature increase by, for example, increasing the amount of sulfur dioxide as a pollutant in the atmosphere. So we have an interesting seesaw type of effect. The more we pollute the environment with acid rain, the more we may be able to cool off various portions of the environment. That's a poor trade-off. That's just the temperature part of global warming. I think the correct term is that we should be worrying about global change, which is not just a temperature increase in some parts of the world, but it will be, without a doubt, a dramatic change in climate in general. And I can even use the word dramatic because we know that there are both naturally occurring dramatic changes in climate and also humanly potentially humanly produced dramatic changes in climate. So that means that not only should we be looking at potential changes in temperature, but also wind speed, precipitation, dryness, humidity, on and on.
So from what you're learning from examining the ice core in Greenland, what concerns do you have about environmental conditions today?
Well, I can answer that best by giving you one small example of something that we found in central Greenland and then tracked to a much larger area. The Chernobyl event of the mid-1980s, that it was a disastrous event in terms of population and in terms of the high latitudes of the Northern Hemisphere. From a scientific point of view, it provided us, although it was a very unfortunate event, it did provide us with a radioactive marker, which allowed us to trace the distribution of the Chernobyl fallout throughout the Arctic. And many scientists found evidence of this in the Greenland ice sheet, throughout all of the snowpacks in northern Scandinavia, on and on and on. But 18 months after the Chernobyl event, we were down at the South Pole in Antarctica, and we were digging a snow pit there. And when we came back to the laboratory, we analyzed that record, and we were able to find evidence of Chernobyl having traveled all the way to the South Pole. It was not at the radioactive levels were certainly not high enough to be of any danger whatsoever, but it did act as an excellent marker. And what it demonstrates is that even very, very small sources, and relatively in a global scale, the Chernobyl event was a very short event, and it came from a very, very small source, can make their way, in many cases, throughout the entire globe. But tells us that the climate and the atmosphere is very, very sensitive even to small changes.
From the ice records that you've been able to gather, can you make any predictions about the future?
One of the things we would dearly like to do is to be able to make a prediction about the future. And we can't do that right now, but I really do think that we will be able to make a very significant contribution to our understanding of future climate within a very short period of time. And I say that with some confidence because we have at our disposal now a time machine, the most detailed record of paleoclimate, paleoatmosphere, paleoenvironment that has ever been created. What we can do with this record and what we are doing right now, and it'll take us a couple more years because we need to analyze many more samples that we've recovered this year, is to understand as well as we can, make a giant step forward in our understanding of how climate works and whether or not there are cycles in climate, whether or not these cycles are simple or not. Once we understand the pattern of climate, we should be able to predict what natural climate would have done if it had not been for humans entering the scene in an industrial sense in the last 100 to 150 years.
Let me ask you about some of the conditions that you work in up in Greenland. I know you've worked in the Himalayas. You've also worked down in Antarctica. Is it a difficult transition for you to live both in New Hampshire, as you do, and to move into these very remote, distant regions of the world?
Perhaps the most honest way to answer that is to say yes, whenever we make this sort of transition. The first few days are very difficult. It's wonderful to be home, but it's certainly strange to be back in a warm environment. If we've been working in Greenland, we come back from very cold temperatures, sometimes to be greeted by a heat wave, and even more strangely, to be greeted by darkness, which is something that you can is a great shock to your system. It's as big a shock coming back to darkness.
Do you change your diet at all when you're living completely in a cold environment?
Yes. In fact, diet is perhaps one of the great pleasures of being in these very, very cold environments because we eat anything between 6,000 and 10,000 calories a day in order to keep warm. And that isn't necessarily because we're moving or traveling a lot. You burn up a great deal of energy just trying to stand in one place, which we sometimes have to do when we're processing the core.
Do you miss the night?
No. Not at all. I miss a lot of things when I leave, but I don't miss the night. It's a great experience being able to live in a place that's light all the time. Many of us seem to have a lot more energy. Given my choice, I'd live in a place that was 24 hours of daylight all year round. It would mean a great deal of moving from the northern to the southern hemisphere, but I think it's certainly a preferable situation.
You work in very remote parts of the world. Is this dangerous work that you do?
It certainly is work that, in terms of danger, it's work that one has to take very, very seriously. I've been doing this work for 25 years, and I've led a great number of expeditions, and safety is the most important thing that we think about Number one is safety, and number two is making sure that that the people involved in these programs are doing well emotionally. The science is very, very important, but it follows right on track with those first two.
Have you had some close calls?
Certainly everybody in this sort of business has had has experienced very, very serious storms. We've been in storms in the Antarctic in our tents that are over 100 miles per hour, and you always feel as if you're on the edge when you're in a little piece of canvas with some metal poles, experiencing the equivalent of a freight train coming by every now and then for several days. Sometimes the snowstorms are extremely intense. There are whiteout conditions when you literally can't see your finger 3 inches away from your eyes. There are, in some areas, the danger of avalanche and crevasses. So there are times when suddenly you feel very unsure of the situation. But that's why you surround yourself with a good team of people. And usually what happens is if one person begins to feel that way, the others don't feel that way, at least temporarily. And as a group, you keep yourselves nice and calm.
You've been able to look back some 250,000 years or so. Do you have fantasies about a favorite year?
Actually, in a way, yes. I'm particularly interested in being able to pick some interesting time periods. For example, the sinking of the Spanish Armada in the early 1500s was a major turning point in the wars between the Spanish and the British. And that the sinking occurred, I believe, during a time when the Spanish were about to attack the British and they were caught in a terrible storm. It would be very, very interesting to find out, to document that storm in our ice core, which I think we can do, and then find out, was this a time period when there were many, many storms, or was it simply a freak accident that the Spanish were caught in and it effectively changed history? There are many interesting associations between dramatic changes in history and dramatic changes in climate.
Thank you very much for talking to us today and telling us about your work. I appreciate the time.
Thank you very much.
Paul Majewski teaches at the University of New Hampshire. Next week, he'll present his findings from his Greenland research at the meeting of the Geophysical Union in San Francisco. I'm Artie Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.